You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, a very special bonus episode covering the Strangers prequel trilogy and the eclectic journeyman genre cinema of director Rennie Harlan, featuring Gnarly Prisons, Andrew Dice Clay, multiple sequels, multiple slashers, Amnesiac Super Spies, Cliffhangers, Pirates, Mindhunters, Race Car Drivers, Chinese Productions, Hercules, and Super Smart Killer Sharks. Martin.
Yes.
Everyone knows when you make an assumption, you make an ass out of you and umption. My hat is like a shark, yeah. Looking for human flesh to rip my teeth through. Other fish in the sea, but barracudas ain't equal to a half-human predator created by a needle. Jet black eyes, baby, they stare while you sleep. A little Titanic sink, I'm the one you gon' meet. Hearing terrified screams, they surround my team. All you see is trails of blood, even God won't intervene. Nightmares of darkness, my appetite is heartless. Even if we related, you eliminated regardless. In the deep blue underwater dog.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, I think we picked a topic to explicitly torture ourselves.
This was one of the worst.
Yeah. For everybody listening, obviously, this is going to be about the new Strangers trilogy from Rennie Harlan that's been put out through Lionsgate, playing in theaters, and then quickly going to streaming. I wouldn't be surprised if by the time this episode is up, the third movie is out on streaming and you can watch them all together. But we're going to first cover kind of the filmography of Harlan and then do a separate segment at the end. Instead of questions, we're just going to go over the Strangers movies themselves. But before we do that, let me ask first, what's your relationship to the original Strangers?
I love it.
Okay.
I think we talked off mic. I saw this when it first came out Friday night. I was home in Indiana. It was 2008, right? Yeah. And I saw my buddy Aaron. And I was just scared. I was scared shitless. I thought it was a really good, you know, slowly paced, but like really like well put together, simple conceit.
Methodical.
Methodical. And just well done. I think there's a lot of great misdirects. I mean, the whole thing with Glenn Howerton showing up to check on them and they getting blasted in the face with a shotgun. Like Bertina's is really good with like a really like functional filmmaking of suspense.
Yeah.
You know,
100%. It's actually kind of shocking that he didn't. I thought he was going to be like a major voice in horror like afterwards. And he's had a career, you know, but he really has never replicated the success or even like the quality of The Strangers, because even though I don't love this movie the same way that you do or a lot of people do, it's kind of become canonized in modern horror as kind of one of the contemporary classics. I don't really see it that way. I think it's an interesting stylistic exercise. It's a guy kind of showing that he's got a bunch of chops. He's really doing the John Carpenter Halloween thing of like playing with deep focus, playing with cinematography, playing with like characters moving in the background. And that, to your point, like that the kind of slow creeping like sense of dread before the violence like really explodes in the end. But like it just never. I think my brain was always wired in that way of like, well, I have Halloween. Why do I need The Strangers? Because ultimately, I think the message or what makes the both movies scary is kind of similar too, in that it's literally about the randomness of violence and how there's no real explanation. Sometimes evil just finds you and there's no escaping it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, on rewatch, I don't think it ages super well. I mean, I love it, but like this is pre-A24 horror, you know, but it today would be an A24 film.
Oh, undoubtedly.
You know, it's artsy looking. It's got actors of caliber like, you know, Scott Speedman and Liv Tyler, who are both really good in it. And you have, again, that slow burn kind of feel and the mysterious feel of like, who are these people? What do they want? I think what makes the film kind of have staying power is, like you said, the randomness, because for me, the moment of the film still is Tamara home. Like the beginning of, you get a knock on a door. It's almost like an urban legend feel, right? You're like, it's almost like a parking urban legend story, but it's like you get this knock and this girl's like, is Tamara home? And that's just genuinely fucking, I think, very scary. But I think the problem that makes it not age well, and we'll talk about later with the problem for the new ones, is that it's not a slasher because you basically have two people being terrorized. Like, it's not like they go through.
No, it's a siege movie.
It's a siege movie, right. And so it's like, but it kind of shops itself as a slasher. And they're dressed like slashers with the masks as well. It kind of, you know, Your Next, I think, does it in an interesting way as well.
The Purge. The Purge heavily borrows from the original Strangers.
Yes.
Right down to the masks.
Yes.
But it's kind of interesting because it is, I think, arguably, despite me not loving the movie, I can't deny that it might be one of the most influential horror movies of the 2000s, just in terms of how many people have like ripped it off or tried to redo it. And frankly, just like, we have one sequel with Strangers Pray at Night.
Yep.
And then you have this entire prequel trilogy. So it's like, obviously it's seen.
Or just remake trilogy, weirdly.
That's
Because the first one's a remake.
Well, and that's the thing we got to get into too, is that it's like, why does this even exist? What place does it even fill kind of in the world? But I think that's the greater point, is that it's like, this is obviously viable IP for these producers and stuff who think they can keep capitalizing on the Strangers iconography because it's gotten so ubiquitous with genre fans.
Well, and it's also similar with the Halloween feel of, you know, Michael Myers in the original script and in the credits was the Shape, right? It was this very much like, while he is Michael Myers, Laurie doesn't know that. It's the whole thing in part two where she's like, Michael Myers, you don't have the mythology in the first one of Laurie's his sister. You don't have any of that. It's just like also the randomness, because you have that moment of she happens to be the one who drops the key off at the Myers house with Tommy. Like
right.
That, in the original, like, that's supposed to be, she's been singled out for that reason, is she came to his house. That's it.
Right.
Wrong place, wrong time, which is why the Strangers, when it's at its best, is that the whole kind of thing of, why are you doing this? Because you were home.
Well, and it's also the thing that both the Strangers, I guess, franchise at this point shares with Halloween 2, is that one of its biggest mistakes was ever trying to explain away
100%
why this evil exists. Like, even John Carpenter, you know, as we've kind of gone into with our own Halloween episode, is Carpenter himself was like, one of the dumbest things we ever did was make Laurie and Michael brother and sister, and like have like a blood connection and then like an explanation behind it, because it robs the central evil enigma of its true kind of like mystery and menace in a way.
Yeah, because it happens. We talked about it with Hellraiser as well. You know, it was Candyman in particular, how like Candyman 1 still has so much mystery to it. And you have,
and then Farewell to the Flesh is just all backstory.
Well, backstory plus, like, how do you beat him? You got to use the mirror. And it's like, what the fuck?
Well,
it
turns him into Freddy Krueger. Everybody eventually, it's like
Black Phone 2.
Yeah, Black Phone 2 too. But it's the Batman thing of like, you start as Batman, but like most audiences want the Joker. They want like this villain. They want an explanation, and that's what they cling on to. And like, the idea is that like Batman's kind of a boring character when he's just this vigilante. So like, how do we spruce this up? We make the villains around him much more colorful, and that's what people end up signing up for. It's that mentality that goes to these slasher villains and these icons, that it's like, you know, everybody has to have a backstory. Everybody has to have an explanation. They have to have a motive. And like, I also think it's part of like, and we'll get into this more as we get into the actual Strangers trilogy itself. But I do think it's a wider, if we're going to go with like a galaxy brain explanation, especially these days, but it is the way that we pathologize and speak to each other and have very much accepted like therapy speak, and everybody has to talk about their trauma and their childhood and their backstory. And like, that's essentially what this does with the Strangers, for better and worse, because there are parts of it that I think are interesting.
Yeah,
that it is, like, in terms of like the trauma and the violence that the actual killers experience, you know, in their youth, like, there is interesting ideas buried in there, but I think it is kind of a cloying cash grab approach to modern audiences and how they think about these characters and how they always want to psychologize them.
Yep.
So before we get to that, though, let's talk about Renny Harlin for a bit.
Yes,
because I feel like we both have pretty long-standing, complicated relationships to this guy's body of work, because it stretches back all the way to when we were literally kids.
Yep.
Like, I'd never seen his first movie, Born American.
Yep.
Did you watch this one?
I watched half of it, honestly. I
liked it.
I was trying to get caught up on other stuff, and I sadly just didn't finish this one.
It feels like a Canon Films version of Midnight Express.
Right.
Where it's like, it's half this like snowy chase film about these tourists basically trying to get to the Finnish border, because Renny Harlin's a Finnish filmmaker, and getting hunted down by Russian agents, thrown into prison, tortured, and put into exactly like a Midnight Express kind of style prison, and like their attempts to escape from it and how they endure like all the punishment. But like, it's filtered through Renny Harlin's almost like fully formed kind of vision for like action filmmaking, that you can watch it and you can see why this guy was brought to America to make stuff like Die Hard 2 and The Long Kiss Goodnight and Cliffhanger. Like, he instantly just had a knack for like action set pieces, chases, and like being a straight up entertainer, as opposed to like, you know, he's not making Midnight Express. He's not making an art movie about prison. He's making an action film.
Yeah, he's never been a guy for nuance. You know, like, I love Renny Harlin, but especially when it comes to performance too, he's gotten good performances out of good actors who just bring that themselves. I don't think he's bringing a really nuanced approach to working with performers, and that, you know, in terms of like depth.
No, I would agree, but I do think there's something to be said for some of the performers who work with him in multiple productions. I mean, Stallone, who's obviously notoriously difficult to work with, has worked with him on one classic and one unwatchable piece of garbage.
Yep.
You know, Gina Davis, who he was married to, so that definitely helps, but they've worked together multiple times. Samuel L. Jackson is in Long Kiss Goodnight and Deep Blue Sea. Like, he gets these big movie stars to keep signing up for his productions, and I don't think, I mean, there's something to be said for that. Like, because a lot of these people, if they think that a guy's a complete amateur or like a dipshit or whatever, they're not going to come back for more.
No, and I wasn't trying to speak disparagingly. I just think that he has a broad...
Oh, no, I wasn't saying that either, but because I agree with you on broad strokes. Like, you're not watching Renny Harlin movies for the performances. You're watching them for the action. But there is... It's kind of like how we talk about George P. Cosmatos, which I thought a lot about when we were watching these movies, is that they're almost like Harlan, he's a better director than Cosmatos, but they kind of both own the same skill set in terms of they're almost like project managers who are like, we're able to do these huge scale productions. We're able to bring them in on time, on budget. We're able to work with major movie stars. Like, it's just, that's a skill set unto itself.
I remember in when I was in grad school and I had this film teacher and he goes, you know why Michael Bay is the best filmmaker in the world? I'm like, what are you fucking talking about? He goes, he gets films done on time, under budget, and they make $1 billion.
Yeah.
And it's like similar. I thought of Michael Bay quite a bit with Harlan as well. If there's a Bayhem quality to some of his action scenes of just, you're like, oh my God, like an insanity. But I think also like watching all these films kind of mostly in order was like, he's a set piece king.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
he's great at it.
He just locks in and you're like, oh, this scene is this. Like, it's not, you know, some action films, like the scenes kind of run together. He's like, nope, this is this set piece. This is this cool. And it's all like very, and really insane shit as,
oh,
he,
yeah,
as he gets later in his career.
Well, I mean, Die Hard 2 is like one of the great examples of that, is that like, you know, Die Hard, don't, as I say this, people listening, don't crucify me, but like, Die Hard is obviously the better movie. McTiernan's obviously the better director. But Die Hard 2, anymore as I get older, is the movie I keep coming back to more and more, because I like how ludicrous the entire thing is. And like, it's just a big Cannon Films version of like an Irwin Allen production. It's a disaster movie that just happens to have John McClane like at the center. And also, like, in my book, it's a better Christmas film than the original Die Hard, because it's actually set in the snow, in the winter. It's set on actual Christmas.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a thing that most people have to deal with.
Travel.
When they're traveling, like, at the holidays. Like, it just, it captures the holiday vibe much better, so that when people debate is Die Hard a Christmas movie or not, like, you should just be like, well, even if you don't agree, like, Die Hard 2 is definitely a Christmas film.
Well, it's interesting too, because I think what really makes him stand out, especially a lot of his early stuff, is like a lot of the best 90s action directors, was he would put very difficult scenes in real locations.
Oh yeah.
Like the way he shoots Die Hard 2, you're like, oh my God, the amount of extras, but also like shutting down a real airport to film this. As in Die Hard 1 is still one of my favorite movies, but like, that's a very controlled set. You can see it's like it's a back lot, it's a set. Obviously they have the real building exteriors, but like, it's still very controlled versus, oh, you're gonna shoot in a fucking, like, you know, it's like when they shot in Waterloo Station for Bourne Ultimatum. You're like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's crazy. What you said to the project manager point, like, when you're young, you're like, cool action movie. And when you're older and you just learn a little bit more about film production, you're like, wait, you did what?
Yeah.
Like, how did you do that?
Also, he's just much more of a maximalist than even McTiernan is. And McTiernan's a pretty maximal director, especially with like Predator and Die Hard and everything. But like, none of McTiernan's movies are as big as Die Hard 2, like where you're shooting John McClane out of an ejector seat as a plane explodes behind him. You know, the entire, like, you couldn't get away with some of the stuff that you do in Die Hard 2, like where the terrorists literally crash a plane to make their point. Like, after 9/11, nobody's doing that shit.
Absolutely not.
But it's also like, I mean, to a maybe even greater degree, like, Cliffhanger's pretty impressive just in terms of the stunt work in it, shooting in those mountain ranges, and also getting that incredible villain turn from John Lithgow, which is one of his, like, even when you talk about Lithgow's entire career as a villain, like playing all the stuff for like Brian De Palma, like,
or Dexter, yeah,
and Dexter, Cliffhanger ranks, man.
So this is my favorite Rennie Harlan movie.
Really?
Like, this is my favorite Stallone movie.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I ride hard for Cliffhanger. So
I like it.
I love it. I so we talked about this many times before, but like, there are films when you're watching as your favorite movie, and like, The Abyss is one of those. Cliffhanger is another. Like, if you're like, hey, the rest of cinema has been erased, and I'm like, I'm cool. Like, I'm so in when I'm watching Cliffhanger because I have a lot of emotional connection. Like, I broke my arm in fourth fucking grade, and all I wanted to see was Cliffhanger. My parents were like, we'll rent you Cliffhanger. And so I got to watch Cliffhanger twice in a fucking row with my cast, and I felt great. I was like, and I loved it so much. I was like, so in. And since then, I've watched it just so many times. And again, like, the older I've gotten, and you really take into account, like, how hard it was to shoot this movie. Because the way it mixes, there obviously are some sets they built for some parts on the mountain, but most of it is they're shot in the fucking mountains.
Oh, yeah.
And that was literally Stallone hanging off the side of that, hanging off the bottom of that crevice in the first, like, first 30 seconds.
And what's interesting, too, in terms of, like, Stallone's performance and his physical transformations is that we're all obviously always talking about Stallone in terms of like how jacked he is. In Cliffhanger, he's like the leanest version
right.
of like jacked Stallone, to where like when you watch him hang off the side of those mountains and everything, like he looks like a guy who climbs mountains. He doesn't look like John Rambo. He doesn't look like Rocky. Like, he looks like a totally different character, and he's really good in the movie.
I think that you're getting in that era, too, because he brings this, like, sweetness and, like, world-weariness to the part. Especially, the thing that really makes Cliffhanger stand out, we talked about this off mic, is the opening scene.
Oh, God.
I mean, it is maybe, it's top three best scene that Harlan's ever done. Because
probably,
you were talking about it, I think, how emotional and how it really puts you in this moment. It's these close-ups of, you have these wide shots, but it really is basically Stallone's face, her face, his arm stretching, trying to hold her.
The clip cutting. Bending and about to like snap and let her go.
I've seen it so many times and it still gets me every time, dude. I'm just clenched on my fucking couch watching that scene, and it's so well shot. And again, the Harlan maximalist thing. Who else would have had her fall and then cut back to her with wind whipping in her face as she keeps falling?
Oh, yeah.
It was like we were talking about, you know, Larry Cohen had that sense of like, oh, shit. Like, it's like, how did you do that? Also, like, that's kind of in bad taste, but I like it.
Well, and that's actually a perfect segue. Do you think that comes from being a horror filmmaker so early in his career? Because after Born American, he makes Prison, which is, quite frankly, revisiting it, almost a straight-up demo reel to direct a Nightmare on Elm Street film, which he ends up doing with A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master.
It's also Shocker. It's the same idea of just this, like... when I first saw this, I bought it on Scream Factory because this is pre, like... finding it easily on streaming, right?
This is also like one of Scream Factory's like first releases. Really early.
I was like 2011 or something.
It was before I moved to Austin.
Yeah, I remember picking it up and I was like, this is pretty good. And rewatching it, like, I really liked it a lot more because I watched the special feature, The Making of, and it was fascinating. It was like what really set Harlan apart again was they had no money.
Right.
Like, and this was, you know...
insane cast, though.
Yeah, insane. We have Erwin Yablons, also Halloween connection, producer of Halloween, comes in and they go, let's... And see Courtney Joyner, who wrote a lot of stuff for Full Moon. It's Empire.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's Charles Band. And
Viggo Mortensen.
Viggo is your, like, as, you know, lead. But literally discovered by Harlan. Like, he walked in, like, he hadn't really done a lot before that. He'd been in Witness.
Oh, okay.
That was like the only role, and I guess
Is this the same year as Texas Chainsaw 3? Oh, no, it's before Texas Chainsaw
3. Before, because that's 90. Yeah, that's 90.
Yeah, you're right, 1990. This is like 86, 87.
Yeah, and you're right, though, like, but about how he makes the movie feel pretty big for how small it is. Like, they pretty much have one wing of a unused prison they're using. But they make it feel big. They make it feel like a real operating prison. You've got Lane Smith, amazing as the warden.
Total shit heel.
Dude, but he's so good at playing.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
Just a real shithead.
Tiny Lister is one of the inmates.
Why am I forgetting his name? The famous Broadway actor who plays the voodoo guy. Andre Shields.
Yeah.
He was in Hadestown. Amazing. And he's like got this whole thing. You got Kane Hodder playing the killer. And
Chelsea Field from Last Boy Scout.
And from Masters of the Universe.
That's true.
Well, you also have John Carl Beekler, you know, doing all the makeup effects.
Well, and that's the other thing is, like, the gore in this movie is awesome. It's very splattery. It's also, like, again, taking it back to Nightmare on Elm Street, is it's very foggy.
Yep.
Like, he loves his fog machines. He loves his, like, shafts of light. He, like, creates this entire almost, like, dreamscape version of a prison.
Yep.
Because it's all, to your point, like, it is Shocker. It's basically prisoner gets executed, comes back to take revenge on the prison warden who was there during his execution, wreaks havoc supernaturally on, you know, everyone who's currently incarcerated, and, like, just creates this kind of, like, arena of pain inside of this prison. But, like, the set pieces, again, like, when that guy gets boiled alive in his own solitary cell, like, that is fucking awesome.
That's the first one. My favorite, though, which is also, again, very Freddy, is the guy who's he tries to escape, he's crawling through the pipes.
Oh, yeah.
And they impale him, which is, again, a kind of like Freddy controls him. But then they're all eating dinner, and he drops through the ceiling, wrapped in, like, rebar, and guts and blood fly over everyone. And it's, like, the coolest fucking part of this movie.
And it sucks because that was mashed potato day, man.
No, dude, I hadn't seen it in so long, and I, like, screamed with that part. I was like, holy shit. Like,
it's so gross.
It's so awesome.
Also, I think that Scream Factory disc is out of print now, so it's kind of hard to see. So for those who actually will seek this movie out, we'll let you know. There is a great 1080p rip on YouTube that you can watch the entire movie straight through. That's how I did it, because my disc is in storage at the moment.
Yeah.
But, like, you can definitely seek this movie out, but it's become another kind of weird rarity. And then Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. I mean, we've gone over this as we did a Freddy Krueger episode, but, like, not one of my favorite personal Nightmare on Elm Street films, but, like, again, just shows Harlan's knack for this kind of maximalist, silly, set piece driven horror style. And I mean, has one of the best Freddy kills of all time.
The cockroach.
Oh yeah.
That's the number one.
It's so gross.
That's the number one. I was watching, and Val was like, "What are you watching?" I'm like, "I was cooking." And I'm like, "I've seen it so many times." I'm like, "I'm just watching Nightmare 4." And I was like, "Watch this part." And she's like, like, it goes so hard.
It's so gross.
When her arms split and bug hands come down. Like, it's grosser than The Fly. It's just really nasty.
Yeah, because it, like, snaps her arms in half and everything, and it's gnarly. But I know there were production problems on Nightmare 4 where he almost got fired a couple times because, like, he was kind of running over budget and everything. But that also feels, again, sort of like a learning experiment for him of how to handle these big productions kind of, like, moving forward. And then he does Die Hard 2, which, or I guess
he does Ford Fairlane.
Ford Fairlane with Andrew Dice Clay, which, you know, I'm going to let you take this one. I didn't revisit it. I have, I would say, nostalgic tinged memories of liking this movie, and you were like, absolutely not.
Well,
Mr. Clay,
it's complex because we were texting about it with us and James, and, like, one of the things about it is such a time capsule of, here's this guy that the only comedian to sell out Madison Square Garden, I believe. It's like, I was looking up, I went deep.
At least at the time.
At the time. He's like, was one of that era of, like, Eddie Murphy, like, sell out comedy.
Oh, there was nothing like Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah, he was. But so my brain was switching between two gears watching this movie. One, I kind of was laughing. I genuinely liked, ironically, because, like, it's like how we all talk to each other, like, "Hey, fuck you, man." You know, it's like, it's still part of the way we all talk as friends. I think a lot of people do that kind of Italian thing. There's some funny, like, his whole thing is, like, every time he does a shot with someone, he's like, "Here's to you, sucking my dick, ew!" And I'm like,
but I mean, that was his whole act.
I know, and it's like, but it's funny, too, because it's, like, ironically funny, because it's so dumb.
It's because, like, his whole act, I guess, I wonder if you tried, if you asked anybody under the age of 40 about Andrew Dice Clay, would anybody know who the fuck you're talking about? Like, unless it's some, like, irony poisoned, like, Gen Z or Gen Alpha, like, dipshit who thinks that they like Andrew Dice Clay as like an ironic like meme generator. Like, and because his whole act was basically like Little Miss Muffet sat on a trumpet, then I fucked her in the ass. And you're like, all right, I guess, sure. But I mean, his Madison Square Garden special was. Was that too much? It was like a huge HBO special too at the time. Yeah, like, but I mean, but Ford Fairlane was almost like an extension of what he would do in stand-up, because it was. It's just like him being like, "Hey, yo, Jimmy, let me get a shot, and also I fucked your mother last night." You're what, like, "Yeah, sure, Dice, whatever."
What are the other lines? They're just. Hanging there, and he's talking to Gilbert Gottfried, he's his friend. He goes,
"No, talk about another relic from another time."
Oh, it's so weird. He goes,
"R.I.P. Sir."
He turns to him. He goes, "Clint Eastwood, I fucked him." I'm like, "What the fuck?" That's the joke. That's the joke.
And Gilbert Gottfried's like, "Ah, I don't know, Dice."
but it's, dude, it's Joel Silver produced. It's this. Oh, yeah. It's this like.
It's in that Tony Scott, Rennie Harlan. I mean, let's be real. Rennie Harlan is like Dollar General Tony Scott.
Oh, no. The whole time I was watching, I said, this is a Tony Scott movie. It looks It looks like fucking Days of Thunder.
Yeah, it's like, and it's the post Beverly Hills Cop 2 thing where like Tony Scott elevated Beverly Hills Cop. I shouldn't say elevated because Beverly Hills Cop is a near perfect movie.
Yeah.
But like he took the style and elevated it into that 80s anti-realist, like hyper-violent,
the seepy coked tones,
up, like Brigitte Nielsen coming in and blowing people away. Like, it's just like Ford Fairlane is in the same kind of lineage as that. And Rennie Harlan feels like it's almost like how we talk about the propaganda guys after David Fincher.
Yeah.
You know, dudes like Simon West and everything who came after Fincher and who were like these music video and commercial directors and made movies like fucking Swordfish. And it's like Rennie Harlan was like the first version of like Simon West.
Yeah, no. Well, and like Simon West, very hit or miss. Because West has done some stuff that we both really like, but also some really bad shit, too.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, especially as it went along. But, I mean, Harlan's run, when he was really cranking it out, like, it's hard to argue with, like, as much as it's not one of my favorites, like, Dream Master, you know, like, that minted a lot of the Freddy iconography for a lot of people.
Yes.
It brought Freddy into, like, the modern, like, joke master slasher that he became. And then, like, Die Hard 2 is, like, an incredible, like, sequel. One of the ultimate, like, bad vibes, like, action movies from the early 90s, along with, like, Last Boy Scout.
Yeah.
Cliffhanger is, like, I remember even seeing Cliffhanger in theaters when I was a kid, you know, along when my dad would take me to see stuff like that and like Under Siege in the theater with and my mom. And like, I'm young enough to still be watching that and being like, I don't think I should be watching this shit. But like his run, I would argue all the way up through Long Kiss Goodnight, which is my favorite Rennie Harlan film, which is also kind of cheating because it's much more of a Shane Black movie than a Rennie Harlan movie. But like, All the way up through Long Kiss Goodnight, like, he had a lot of great stuff, but he also had one of the most notorious bombs of all time with Cutthroat Island.
So I rewatched that.
Which you have interesting thoughts on, because I like your one take, and I'm going to let you cook a little bit.
So I sometimes feel that Rennie is, like, ahead of the curve on things, and, like, Cutthroat Island is just, it's 8 years before Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
And it's doing the exact same thing.
This is your best take on this movie. And I think...
But you don't. But instead of Johnny Depp, you have Gina Davis. And she's not...
And Matthew Modine.
You have charisma vacuums as your two leads. I love Gina Davis, but like, they are not good in this movie.
Well, and it's also one of the great examples of like being too much of a wife guy.
Yeah.
Because like Rennie Harlan's like, my wife, I love you.
And she's hot. It's like,
and she is smoking hot in Cutthroat Island. But yeah, you can also see that production, like, for as good as the Pirates comparison is, you needed someone with a little more style, a Gore Verbinski type, to make those movies work. because also, and you needed a Johnny Depp in Jack Sparrow. Like that's the thing that holds Cutthroat Island kind of back, is you don't have an iconic character and you really just have maximalism run amok. Because I think that's one of Harlan's downfalls too, is that like if you watch his movies from like any kind of technical perspective, he's a great journeyman carpenter,
yeah,
who construct a movie for you and manage the project perfectly, but you're not getting the little bit of extra icing on the cake like a Gore Verbinski gives you, or certainly like a David Fincher gives you, or anything. Right. Like he's just shooting the movies, and I think as the movies go along and he kind of loses some resources, that becomes more and more readily apparent, because he's able to kind of cover up his lack of distinct auteurist style with just explosions, sword fights, machine gun battles. Like he just piles shit upon shit upon shit upon shit until you're so overwhelmed that you're just kind of like, you're just having fun with it, but like you're not really worried about whether or not the filmmaking is good.
Yeah, I think that you think about, as an example, Cutthroat Island, and, you know...
And that's the one that gets away from it.
Well, and tonally, it's a mess, because, like, it's trying to be the swashbuckling thing, and like, Modine's kind of doing this British accent, and he's supposed to be this kind of cute thing, but it's also supposed to be serious at moments, so
it's very Costner in Robin Hood coded.
Or like, Waterworld. It's very awkward. And also, like, that's the thing, too, is, like, the comedy, none of it's funny. Like, it's all falls flat. But to your point, though, about the maximalism, like, this was kind of the end of that, partly the end of that run, is there are explosions in this movie that blew my fucking mind. Like,
oh, my God, yeah.
Well, and he's a director that, if you watch a lot of his films, he puts his stars in the stunt.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so there's a scene where it's almost like, it looks like a Universal Studios, like, back, like a stunt spectacular, you know, like the Waterworld thing or whatever. And you see Matthew Modine on this, like, zip line while shit's blowing up behind him. And it's Matthew Modine. Like, it's not a composite shot. He's just in the middle of this huge, like, fucking insanity of explosions. Obviously, the same thing with Stallone. It's like he puts people, like, really in this shit. And he sells it. Like, he, you know, and it's almost like in a... Like, I could have seen him if he had been a little younger, like, doing a Fast and the Furious movie.
Oh, 100%.
Like, he's, like, built for that world. Like, a Justin Lin, I think, very much is a Rennie Harlan. Of, like, you gotta be, like, a know-how-to-be a project manager.
Oh, for sure. But, and Cutthroat Island is the movie that ends up bankrupting Caralco, right?
They're done.
Like, sinks it after that, which, RIP, our brothers in Christ, because you gave us Total Recall and Basic Instinct.
Terminator 2,
and then a pirate movie took your ass out.
Oh, my God. Well, and also a lot of Cosmata stuff, like Rambo 2, you know? So, fuck, man.
They were the kings of the sweaty, muscled, coked up, like, just hyper-violent genre exercises that we all loved.
Well, they're also, wouldn't you say they're just, like, I know we both love canon. They're canon with real big stars, like, when they're stars.
Well, and real filmmakers, yeah,
and real money, like, a lot of money.
I mean, like, yeah. They had Paul Verhoeven coming in and making Total Recall and Basic Instinct, and right. Like these guys weren't fucking around. They actually had an eye for talent.
Yeah, I mean, we love Joseph Zito, but he's not, you know, he's not quite that level.
Yeah, as much as I love Invasion USA, it's not as good as most of the Rennie Harlan movies. So Harlan then, unfortunately, I think he has one more great film to his name that you like more than I do, but I love the ludicrousness of it, which is Deep Blue Sea.
Yeah.
But, I mean, outside of that, you got a lot of dog shit. I mean, his Chinese productions. Did you watch, like, Skip Trace?
I watched, like, 5 minutes.
Oh, it's bad, dude.
Yeah, it's a Hercules.
The Bricklayer, his DTV movie with Aaron Eckhart, not particularly great. But also, do you want to You want to speak on, I mean, you started with this movie, which I honestly thought you were trying to find a way to not do this episode, because you started your Renny Harlin run with Driven, which is one of the fucking worst movies I've ever sat through in my life.
This movie goes above and beyond to be the most garish, steaming pile of fucking dog shit. But it's aggressive about it. So here's part of the problem, right? Is A, it sucked when it came out, and B,
it still sucks.
Well, B, it's an example of the worst of all the 2001 editing techniques, the worst of 2001 CG use in action movies. It's all just in one movie, right? So there was that, you know, quick editing, like with their version of like a Hans Zimmer score, which is flashy, 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 low angle shots. I think it was giving me like a fucking, like I was getting dizzy watching the movie.
Well, he's trying to do Bayhem.
Right. It's that. Yeah. Right. 2001. So you're right before he does Bad Boys 2. Right.
And you're after The Rock and Armageddon.
Yeah. So that you're right. It's a really good point. But it is, first of all, Stallone writes the script. And it's not one of his best.
To put it mildly.
It's also the same plot as F1. But there's no drama. So literally he's like, hey kid, you should be a better driver. And the kid's like, okay. Like that's the plot. There's no bad guy. Even Till Schweiger is like the one they're trying to beat, and he's like, oh, we're all on the same side. We're all drivers. I'm like,
we will work together.
It's like
Kit Purdue,
talk about a fucking charisma vacuum. He sucks.
He should be executed.
And then you have Robert Sean Leonard, who's probably one of the better parts, like having fun.
Yeah,
like,
I guess.
Like, but he's terrible in it. But like the part of like he's the brother of Kit Purdue, and he's like his manager, who's basically wants just to get money out of it. He'll use his brother even to get ahead. And it's so fucking.
Well, I mean,
stupid.
He's to your point about the F1 comparison. He's almost the same exact.
Yeah.
Character as the manager in the younger driver of F1.
Yeah, Idris's his cousin. He's like his cousin,
yeah,
I think,
that
his
sounds
best
right.
friend. Yeah, who's like always like, you gotta go to the parties, you gotta do this, like you gotta be flashy, you know, kind of thing. And it's just
I wanna watch F1 again. That movie's good.
I mean, I was talking to a friend, I had a work call yesterday, and she's like, I'm trying to watch every Oscar nom. I haven't watched F1 yet. I said, watch it right now.
Yeah.
And
stop
she,
what you're doing
and
watch
like,
it.
I
now.
Don't really like action, but she's got good taste and shit. And I was like, you're gonna like F1. Trust me. Like
one of the dumbest narratives in this award season is people trying to act like F1 is some offensive inclusion
Shut
in the best picture
up.
Race. Like that movie fucking rules, first of all. And I mean, it's the ultimate like populist pick. Like it's perfect. It's never going to win, but it's nice that we recognized a movie that like is just that big and silly and entertaining.
Well, talk about another filmmaker who is a blast, kind of almost like he is a throwback director. Kaczynski is also a very good project manager of like, you think he's a good visual. I like his style as well, but also you have him doing stuff like shooting Maverick and shooting F1 of like, what if we actually put the cameras in real
planes? Yeah.
Like he is.
Well, Kaczynski's a real filmmaker,
but he also is that kind of like, you have to have that really structured approach, like a very left brain approach to making a movie like that.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think Harlan was good though. At a lot of like, again, these planning of scenes and Driven, the main problem with it is it's so CGI reliant. Like there's very little actual like car action. There's a little bit, but a lot of it's like these CG over the head shots. A lot of like,
well, it's sort of like how much hockey is in Heated Rivalry,
right?
Is that it's just much more about two hot dudes fucking each other,
right?
And then you're like,
they bang, they bang in that show
a couple times.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, they slap. We'll say a lot of wet meat.
I watched the ABC edit. So
wow. Well, you know, we all gotta pick our battles, I guess. But no, it's like I do agree with you. It's like Driven is just one of those things that on paper, honestly, I mean, take Kit Purdue out, I guess, but like on paper, should be pretty good, but is bad.
We also have Burt Reynolds. Who's looking rough in this movie? Like,
because we're post Boogie Nights and the Academy Award nomination and everything,
and he looks sick in it. And like, his character's in a wheelchair, I don't know if that was like they had to, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, he's not in that poor of health at that part, like, because you still have, he's still got 15 so years, like, after that.
Yeah, but he still doesn't look like, you know, we love our boy Bert, but.
Oh, I mean, especially once the surgery and stuff started to take over, you know, Bert was looking pretty ghoulish there at certain points.
Yeah, with the fit. He almost looked like Stan Lee.
He looks like a Ryan Murphy character. R.I.P., sir.
Yes.
You're still my favorite movie star, but R.I.P.
Yeah. Well, then you go from Driven to we skip Deep Blue Sea. We already talked about it in our Shark episode. I'm a big fan of Deep Blue Sea. You like it.
I mean, I have a tough time denying it. It's a, my big, you know, thing with it is that it almost forms a trilogy in a way with Cliffhanger and Die Hard 2, is that the one thing that you can never take away from Rennie Harlan is that he really was kind of like our modern Irwin Allen yeah. style kind of filmmaker, who he just made these big fucking disaster movies. And like with Die Hard 2, he makes his airport movie. And then with Cliffhanger, he makes, you know, this crazy sort of like event climbing movie, almost like his Eager Sanction to a yeah. certain way. Yeah. And then with Deep Blue Sea, like it's just his underwater disaster movie that's probably a little too like monster movie driven to be a full Irwin Allen thing. But like he just revels and really excels in creating chaos. And it's really something to behold.
Well, what's interesting about him too, and I always like about the production of Deep Blue Sea is I had the DVD when it first came out. I was back in like 99 or whatever, and I'd watch it over and over again, all the special features. They had some good ones on there. And the craziest thing was they spent all this money, they built these sharks that actually swim. Like they're
and they're fucking cool.
They're
looking.
Amazing. And but they swim. They're not attached. They don't have to be attached to like wires or anything. Like they can swim on their own. And it's really cool effect. And it's like, again, to your earlier point about this guy with like a sandbox, like I guarantee that was his idea of like, what if we built real sharks, you know? And they do it, and it's like,
and also that scene where the shark bites off Stellan Skarsgård's arm, awesome. Pretty awesome, and literally hurls him like a projectile.
It's hilarious. Like, well, and they also you talk about his mayhem and like the insanity is you have this. It's also the whole plot. It's just Jurassic Park. It's the same plot.
100%.
Right. It's just like weekend of tour. Rain comes. Things go bad, they get unlocked, we're dead, right?
And so, Samuel L. Jackson's involved in both.
Yeah, gets, you know, ignominiously killed in both. But you have this moment where Stellan Skarsgård gets his arm eaten off. They call in...
Which, again, we should pause for a second and highlight...
Oscar nominee
Stellan Skarsgård is in Deep Blue Sea. Like, the cast on this movie, yet again, like a lot of Rennie Harlan projects, is preposterous in hindsight.
I mean, he's almost as good as Michael Rapaport in this movie.
Only slightly better than LL Cool J.
Yes.
LL Cool J is really good in this movie.
This is actually one of my favorite LL Cool J roles, as Preach.
I'm a big In Too Deep supporter.
Right, but of the more, of the kind of action. I'm sorry,
where are you going with this? The more what?
No, that's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these yeah, more
walk
like,
it back.
I'll be careful here. But you have this moment where so they take Stellan Skarsgård up to the surface. They call in air ambulance. They're
God, going, this set piece is insane.
They're going to zip line him. They're going to pull him up with the safety line. He's on his stretcher. It goes up. The wind is so bad that the metal wires in the winch get caught.
It becomes Cliffhanger for like 5 minutes.
And he just drops in. The shark gets him and uses him as a lure and pulls on it, which makes the helicopter attached crash into the fucking tower. Like it blows up. Then the shark throws him, like you said, like a javelin, into the glass, breaks the glass observational wall. You're just like, Harlan, you're fucking crazy, man.
Stellan Skarsgård, Swedish treasure. Thrown through glass by a shark.
Well, it's also the first time you see him is he's peeing, and it's like great introduction. Well, he's peeing, and you have Samuel L. Jackson is like, "Who's that?" And the girl's like, oh, that's Dr. So-and-so, most brilliant man in the world. He's like, he's peeing into the wind. How brilliant can he be?
But Skarsgård, again, treats like every line reading in this like he's Luthen in fucking Andor.
Oh, dude.
He's like, the world is nothing more than flesh and teeth.
Oh, it's so fucking awesome.
You're like, God. Like, the man doesn't have, like, a downshift gear.
No.
Like, he just shows up. He's like, what are the lines? All right, give me a second. These sharks are going to kill everyone. You're like, Jesus, dude, you're the best.
For 5 minutes, you'd know what it was like not to be damned.
He's just absolutely incredible. Like, there's no bad Stellan Skarsgård performance. Well, it just doesn't exist. No,
agreed. And he's so good in this. And, like, another thing I was watching, there's a really great, I'm looking at right now, the 4K for Deep Blue Sea, the Arrow one. Great release, by the way, and great transfer.
It's incredible how these level movies, not to get too far off on a tangent, but like we're literally sitting here with, there's a Deep Blue Sea 4K sitting on my shelf on top of, also by Arrow Films, by the way, a Ninja Turtles box set with all three movies that are remastered in 4K as well. And you're just sitting there being like, do these movies deserve this? Probably not.
Next to Drop Zone, too.
Drop Zone and Gang Related, by the way. They're like glorified, like video store, like shelf stuffers.
Yeah.
It's like when we, you know, yesterday Criterion announced Frankenstein and K-pop Demon Hunters are going to be part of the Criterion Collection, and people fucking like lost their goddamn minds. Like they were letting in like Riefenstahl movies or something inside the collection. And it's like, guys, like we're at the point where like Arrow Films is like Deep Blue Sea 4K for like $40. Fuck yeah, brother. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4Ks. These motherfuckers will eat that shit up. Cinemagraph is putting out Gang Related, a movie that I mostly knew as a VHS tape that sat on, you know, Blockbuster shelves. Like, we've just kind of reached this point with cinephilia where it's just sort of like getting upset about any of this is just fucking stupid because it's all hypocritical. We're all just buying trash that's being repackaged and glossed up for us to consume because, like, we got nothing better to do except wait for Trump to kill us all.
I mean, that's honestly my thought. It's like, well, I'm gonna buy some action figures. I'm gonna buy my 4Ks, and
I'm gonna hang out with my cats.
It's just like,
smoke weed, and I'm gonna watch these discs and just wait for the bombs to drop.
Well, there's in that set though, the Deep Blue Sea set. There's a great like booklet you like eat a lot with the Arrow ones, and there's a lot of the storyboards. And I guess it doesn't surprise me. Harlan is a crazy storyboarder,
and that to your point does make 100% sense because he's such a set piece driven director. Like he seems like a guy who would sketch all this shit out to make sure that every single frame is thought out and links to the one either before or after it.
100%. Like he, again, it's just one of those. I think it's interesting. We talk. You and I both love Workman and Journeyman, right? We both love these kind of filmmakers, and like I don't ever want to take away from someone who was able, like the fact that someone made Cliffhanger, it just still, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
It's, like it's insane to me.
I just think it's important when we talk about these types of filmmakers, because this isn't like disparaging when we say that you're a journeyman or that maybe you lack like an identifiable style or whatever. It's like, there's still virtue and being a guy who can pump these sorts of movies out and do it at such a high level as like what Rennie Harlan did. Like, that's a totally different skill set. It's just when we, and by we, I mean like the kind of collective like film Twitter we, is that we start assigning these auteurist labels to maybe some guys who don't necessarily like deserve it. And that's okay.
Yeah.
Like it's okay that they're not auteurs. We just need to start using the word a little more judiciously, because like Rennie Harlan's not an auteur, but he's still a fucking incredible entertainer.
Well, yeah, and not auteur, but the consistency of, you could rely on the 90s and Rennie Harlan with the kind of budget, you're gonna have a great time, right?
I've watched Die Hard 2 most, probably more than most movies.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, Cliffhanger is up there. And honestly, I've watched Deep Blue Sea way too many fucking times.
Oh, God, dude. I saw Deep Blue Sea in theaters at least three times. And it's just kind of like, because I was 17 years old. It came out during the summer of 1999. And that movie completely ripped with an audience.
Dude, it's amazing. Like, I can't, you know, again, he was kind of a little bit early to the game of, like, sharks weren't really hot at that moment, and they really came back in with, like, the Asylum movies, the Sharknadoes, the 47 Meters Down, the Open Waters. He was ahead of the curve again. He really was. Like, he kind of had a finger. Obviously, he didn't write the script, but he had a finger on the pulse of, like, what people were interested in.
Well, I mean, and I want to talk about one last movie before we get to the actual Strangers segment. I mean, to your point, Mindhunters.
Oh, yeah.
One of his movies that he made, and I believe they shot before Saw, and then it was delayed because of the Dimension, Disney, Weinstein. Yeah, it got shelved
for years.
Yeah. Well, it got shelved because, you know, Disney and the Weinsteins basically, like, split up. You know, it got kind of held up, and that whole deal was supposed to be released. He even took some time to, like, re-edit and, like, strengthen everything. But if you watch Mindhunters, it's like proto-Saw.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot of, like...
Law-abiding citizen meets proto-Saw.
Exactly.
Right? Like...
With, like, criminal profilers, which would become, like, the huge thing on TV.
Yep.
You know, it's almost like... What was that, the one show with Mandy Patinkin, Criminal Minds?
Yeah.
That was on for... It's almost like if you took the Criminal Minds people, put them on an island, and faced them off against Jigsaw. Like, that's your fucking movie. And the set pieces in that are awesome. And also, incredible cast. Like, Christian Slater's in this movie.
Val Kilmer,
Clifton Collins Jr. Like, he just assembles this great squad.
Johnny Lee Miller's great in this, too. Well, actually, no, he's not. Sorry.
No, Johnny Lee Miller's accent is a war crime. No,
sorry, he's very bad. Sorry.
He's a Scottish guy trying to do the American Southern accent, and it sounds like this, and you're like, sir, stop. I would rather you just be Scottish.
I meant it more fun. Yeah, he's funnily great. Like, oh, yeah. Like, he's bringing
He's
it.
Hamming it.
He's like Lithgow, right? You're just like, oh, he's here. But you're, to your point, too, like, another movie, though, of set pieces.
There's
a whole set piece, which
they're
also,
all traps. They're Saw traps.
Well, and he talked about it with, you know, Deep Blue Sea, how the scene in the... when they're climbing the central staircase in Deep Blue Sea, and you have the ladder falls across, and they're hanging over. He goes, oh, this is my fault. This is basically my tribute to Cliffhanger, right? And you kind of have it again with in Mindhunter, where you have Clifton Collins Jr., who's in a wheelchair, hanging from these pipes, and you have LL Cool J walking across these pipes on the side of the wall because it's all electrocuted. It's all electrified. It's like, and it's so well put together. Like, it's like, again, like, you, it could have looked so shitty in another person's hands, but, like, and it's a schlocky movie, but it's also kind of a cool, like, modern, like, Agatha Christie, like, Then There Were None.
Oh, yeah.
Kinda, it's the same kind of setup.
It's just an elevated B movie. I called it on Letterboxd a techno giallo.
Yeah.
To where it's doing a specific thing. And again, Harlan's just really good at that specific thing.
And a really dumb underwater gunfight. Which I like, though.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of a cool thing.
Like, I like the whole movie. That's a great midnight movie.
Another one I watched that I didn't hate was Devil's Pass.
I still never seen this one.
So it's funny, you know, I feel very... Well, this kind of, I think, is a good lead-in before... We'll take a break before we get to The Strangers specifically, but... This is also him doing his version of a genre he doesn't really know well. So, like, he was a horror guy, but he's not a modern horror guy, right?
Okay.
I feel like he's a little behind. And this is a found footage movie. And so, but it's like 2008, so it's pretty late, you know, in the game for some of it. But it's right around the time of Paranormal Activity. The setup, though, pure pulpy madness is, this is a true story of the Dyatlov Pass, and I believe it's in Ukraine. It's the famous story of these backpackers, scientists, went on this long hike, went missing, and they found them all naked. It's this whole thing of, like, and people think it was, you know, but it could have been just a thing that happens when you get super, super bad hypothermia, you think you're burning up, so people will take their clothes off. But in this movie, it's like, well, what if actually they stumbled upon, a secret Russian base that was doing, doing studies on portals that turn people into monsters in the side of a mountain that also has time travel involved.
Well, it's out of a Stephen King story. It's like almost like, what if you stumbled on the base from the mist?
Yes, it's like that. It's like that. And like the main problem of the movie is, and I looked at behind the scenes stuff, they did this amazing makeup on the monsters. And this is 2008, so he goes, oh, fuck it, let's just do CG. So it looks like the monsters from, like, I Am Legend. These, like, big bummer. Rubbery things. So I'm like, well, that's dumb. But, like, I was looking at all these behind-the-scenes shots at these, like, feral. They're almost like the creatures from Bone Tomahawk. Ooh. These, like, feral things. And I'm like, that's fucking cool. But to our listeners, I wouldn't say go out of your way and watch Devil's Pass, but it was an interesting curio.
You've sold me.
Yeah.
I'll watch it since I missed it for this homework
project. I think you actually might like it. It's fun.
You want to get to The Strangers?
Let's do it.
All right. We're back talking about Renny Harlin's Strangers. Well, let's do this first. How do we define this? This is sort of a prequel, but sort of a remake, but also sort of an extension. This is a really idiosyncratic and unique trilogy of movies, I guess. I mean, they are movies. I don't want to second guess that, but like, I'm just going to kick it to you. What do we call this?
I just call it a reboot trilogy that happens to have a new mythology.
Rebootquel?
Yeah. Rebootquel with like prequel stuff that explains
Tamara.
What happens in this version. So it's still, you know, but yeah, you get.
So let's, okay. Yeah. Now let's jump off of that. In this version, does this not, if it's a prequel, does it not connect to the Liv Tyler, Scott Speedman, Brian Bertino movie? Because it sort of does.
Well, I don't think. Well, technically, they could have been other victims, but this plot is identical. Like, the character plot is very similar to Liv Tyler. Original. Yeah, because it's like in the original, they were at a wedding and he wanted to propose to her. She basically is like, I'm not ready. They have the awkward, like, well, I had a romantic place rented for us. Then the killing happens. This one is car breaks down, or someone fucked with their car when they were in a diner. And now they're at a very similar place and has a very similar ending with them tied up together, tortured, and then
one's killed in front of the other.
And yeah, and in the original, like, they both die, but Liv Tyler, like, has the last gasp where she reaches for the kid, like, the kind of last stinger of the movie. And this has the idea of, well, what if the main girl just didn't die? And so I look at it as a complete remake. Like, the first one, okay.
The first one is just a remake.
Is a remake. So you have three chapters. And you have chapter one, which is literally, like, pretty much beat for beat, a remake. Same thing, too, with the shotgun, but instead of it being with the Glenn Howerton character, it's like they call the guy who owns the Airbnb they're using, and then they
shoot him with a crossbow.
They shoot him with a fucking, yeah, it's...
The guy from Andor.
That's the best part, too.
Oh, is that part two?
That guy gets the arrow, and then the guy who is like the Airbnb owner is a different dude who gets shotgun blasted by
right.
The guy. So it's really weird because the first one feels like a case study in what if you had a really solid, like, kind of slow burn horror thriller and you gave it to a maximalist, more ham-fisted director, and that's what you get. And it reminds me, it's very similar situation to, I actually also, one movie we did pass up was Exorcist the Beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a similar situation of you had...
I didn't go back to that well.
But I did. And you have, Schrader does Dominion,
bad.
Which is also bad. But then the studio's like, no, there's like no action in this, which is fair.
You made a Paul Schrader movie.
Yeah, and he did. And it's not even a horror film. And then you have, then they bring in Harlan to say, all right, you can use a lot of the same sets. Well, you can keep Stellan Skarsgård, but like recast everything, make it sexier. And that movie's terrible. And
all right, here's my hottest take. I actually prefer the Ready Harlow one to the Paul Schrader one.
Oh, me too.
But, okay.
Yeah, no, I think like the
Paul Schrader one's such a slog.
It's
just through.
It's brutal. Actually, worse special effects too. It's weird. Like, well, they also didn't really finish it, and they kind of like put stuff together for that DVD, that Blu-ray release or whatever, right, when they put it out. But no, it feels similar where you have, or even if you think about it as Rennie Harlan playing in a franchise that has hit pretty high highs. When you think about specifically the original Exorcist and also Exorcist 3. And it's very, it's just very big and brash as you expect from Harlan. And this one feels similar where it's like, first of all, you have the most unlikable characters as your two leads. Like, they are literally right out of, like, a fucking magazine. Like, they're both perfect-looking people that I don't give a shit about.
They have, like, no chemistry.
No chemistry. They're both, like, attractive young people, but they suck.
Yeah.
Like, and she's a producer. Like, the girl, I think, was part of, like, the production team.
Really?
Yeah, because, I mean, she'd be...
I didn't spend that much time going over the credits of it, but if she's a producer on this... Wild choice to cast yourself as the dumbest character in the first movie. She gets better as the films go along, but like, and I, you could also argue that it's sort of purposeful that she goes from helpless, like, dimwit to like full on like murderer by the end of the third film. But it's like, I don't know, man. Like, she. She's such a thinly drawn, shrill, boring character in the first movie. Like, the first movie sucks. Like, I'm not going to lie.
It sucks so bad.
Like, I almost texted you after the first one. I was like, are we sure we want to do this? Because, like, I struggled to get through it. It took me two different sittings, starting and stopping it, to get through to where I finally just... got super high to where I couldn't move from the couch and stared at it until it was over. And even then I was like, why did we do this? Like, I fully didn't understand the motivation to make these fucking movies beyond IP, like beyond just cashing in and being like, here's strangers for a new generation. But even then it like, it, you brought a director in Rennie Harlan. And you got to wonder if it's one of those things where, like, Rennie Harlan just had some bills he needed to pay.
Yeah.
And signed up as, like... And also, like, coming from, you know, making horror sequels so early in his career, you know, making Prison, making Nightmare 4, and if he was... And making the Exorcist movies, which we didn't even really talk about. Like, I wonder if he... was just like, sure, and the producers... what I mean, because it's also produced by Courtney Solomon...
Mm.
Who was the king of the After Dark label.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Which also makes sense because it's kind of a cash-in, and he's a real C-grade kind of exploitation producer.
Kind of, yeah.
So, like, the pieces sort of make sense, again, on paper, but then you watch it, and it almost becomes a case study in where Brian Bertino used it to showcase his kind of, like, his technical skills with a camera in like a minimalist setting, to where you have this maximalist director, to where if you strip away all of the real set pieces and explosions and gore, because there's no gore in like
That's
all
like
three
the
of
worst
these
part.
Films.
Yeah.
Like, all the kills are incredibly boring. Like, half of the people die, they get stabbed in the stomach and like keel over, and you're like, it's like when you would like play like, you know, horror movie like characters with your friends when you were like a little kid, and you would just stab them, they'd fall and be like, oh, I'm dead. And it's like, that's what happens in this movie.
To many people.
And it's like, but it almost reveals Harlan's limitations as a director, because like there's none of the excess that we were describing in the previous segment to cover up the fact that he's just pointing and shooting. And at this, and here he's pointing and shooting at nothing that's really that fucking interesting, because we've already seen it done not once but twice with Strangers Pray at Night. And
which is
a director that we really like,
yeah,
in Johannes Roberts. And like Johannes Roberts' version of it, if you want to use that as like a great compare and contrast kind of case study, is like he took the Strangers IP and was like, what if I just made an 80s slasher,
yep,
and put neon in it and put needle drops and had Christina Hendricks and like just did the thing.
At a trailer park, yeah.
But did like what he has proven himself with like Primate and the 47 Meters Down films and stuff, is like what he's so good at is he's like, I'm just going to take this thing that was originally kind of like a minimalist cerebral like horror movie about, you know, random evil, and I'm just gonna make it a slasher.
Yeah,
like I'm just gonna do the thing. I'm gonna give you a cheap thrill. Where here, like Renny Harlin, he almost seems, and what's crazy is that like he is a guy, as we've already kind of gone through, who's like a really grade A entertainer. And like he doesn't almost have anything to work with to entertain us. He just kind of shoots the thing and then turns it in. And you're like, it's like if a guy like kind of did his homework the night before it was due and he just crammed in like a 10 page term paper and was like, here. And like functionally, like you look at it, you're like, cool, C plus, I guess, like bye.
Yeah, no, this feels, and I think it's interesting you tell me what the producing history is of who made this. I mean, obviously, cash grab, right? But
there's no other reason.
All I can imagine, though, imagine what the conversation was like with Lionsgate, where it's like, what if I, for the budget of one movie, could give you three horror films in a series that come out, because they're one a year, right?
Okay.
So even if they suck, we're going to more than make our money back. Right. Like I went and there were people in my fucking theater. You know what I mean?
And they all got theatrical releases and they were in like right now, Chapter 3 is still in theaters.
Yeah.
Like it's literally at the Cinemark, like right down the road from us.
Yep.
So like these have hung around and like made some money.
Yeah. I think they made their money back, but it feels so cynical where it's like,
because there's no marketing for them.
Well, especially with the third one, they're just like,
get it out of here.
And I think it's a sense of just like, well, and so I read a little bit about the backstory of them making it. And so what they did is they would literally shoot like all day. They'd shoot like 16-hour days and they would shoot from each part. So they
Do you know where they filmed this? Was this like one of those Bulgaria fucking productions or whatever?
I don't know where it is. No. I think it might be Arkansas.
Okay.
For some reason. Why is it Arkansas? No, maybe not. But what's interesting about it is they, I don't think it's Arkansas, but
it's not some like tax shelter country.
I don't believe so.
Shoot mostly like Scott Adkins movies.
Right. Or Dolph, you know. But what I understand was they would shoot whatever, they show all the movies at once, right? which we knew. But they'd be like, all right, she's like, yeah, in the morning scenes, I would be dressed for part one or later in part two.
Mm-hmm.
And then that night we would shoot part one and then other parts of part two and three. They're just jumping around, which also adds to probably, I imagine, the schizophrenic nature of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, of like, it's just all over the place. And I think the biggest sin of this movie, we talked about it off mic, was you and I both like good horror mythology, right? We are like, cool, if you're going to go deeper into something, this is not a series that needs that, period. But if you are going to do it, the only mythology we get is, oh, they killed people when they were kids. And there's a reason, there was a game, the Tamara game or whatever, or they killed a girl named Tamara. Sorry, spoiler. And then...
These were filmed in Slovakia, by the way. So I was totally right.
You were right. But then, that makes sense. And then you have, on top of that, nothing that is revealed in 2 and 3 adds anything to the movie, to the understanding of the world, that makes it more interesting. It's just like, you said there's a little bit of like, okay, they were killers as kids. And then also, oh, that guy's dad. And that's that, and that's the killer. It's more like who's behind the mask is the only question you have.
So here's my theory. I could be totally off base, but watching these, I'm shocked that they put them in theaters. I honestly think they shot this with the idea of selling it to like a Netflix or a Hulu or something right. as a binge-worthy series.
Like Fear Street.
Like Fear Street or even the Scream series when it first came out.
Yeah.
But that was more of like a regular episodic thing. But like Fear Street's probably the best example yeah. to your point. But it's like I truly believe they shot it hoping that they could sell it to a streamer. The streamer would release it to binge it. Because the thing about these movies is that to their credit, Chapter 2 picks up right where Chapter 1 left off.
Yeah, real Halloween 2 action, yeah.
And it picks up right where Chapter 2 left off. And they feel like episodes in a series. They don't feel like movies. And they're small. They're kind of flatly shot. They look like TV.
Yeah, digital, yeah.
And I just think nobody picked them up, and Lionsgate ended up buying it and then was like, well, we don't really have an outlet for this to basically go to streaming. We're going to put it in theaters, make the money, and then kind of just go from there. But it really feels like a streaming series that somehow got released as three theatrical releases. And it's just because they're baffling. And like episode two or chapter two, whatever we want to call it, is like better than one. But here's the problem. I mean, Halloween 2 is a great, great comparison point because it, you know, it has this whole hospital set piece in the beginning where she's being chased by the strangers, and then it becomes about her battling back against them. You get some backstory into the two to where, like, we find out that the one was, like, the waitress at the diner that they see. And then you dive into, like, her childhood yeah. trauma. And then you find out that she was basically trauma bonded with another kid who was also, like, a psycho and who, like, killed on her behalf. And then, you know, we keep flashing back to these things. And that's when, like, any kind of structure really starts getting implemented to where you finally start to see something at least resembling a grand design for yeah. all three of yeah. these things, but you're still kind of left wanting, sitting there being like, I still don't fully understand why we took this 5.5 hour endeavor or whatever to where it's like, or I guess 4.5 hour if you do, because yeah. thankfully chapter three is like barely 80 minutes long. I don't even think like before credits it's even 80 minutes, but like, you watch it, and then chapter two is clearly intended as almost like the Empire Strikes Back of these the Strangers trilogy. It ends on a down note where she strikes back and kills one of the strangers, and now the ball's back in their court to where they have to go after her again. But the problem with these movies is the slasher stuff is the worst part of them. Like all yeah. of the set pieces feel completely perfunctory.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is crazy because as we kind of outlined, like Harlan's really great at set pieces and these feel so phoned in. Just kind of like, well, what if we did like a hospital chase? And we'll do another chase during the woods. At least in episode or chapter two, you have
the boar.
The boar attack is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Where she just randomly, you know, she's getting chased through the woods and randomly gets attacked by a giant boar. But like, I don't know, man. It's a baffling decision. And then you get to chapter three, which is like all backstory. It's like you made the comparison to like, and I do think this is the energy they were trying to capture and just failed, is the David Gordon Green and Danny McBride Halloween trilogy.
Yeah.
Is that it does feel like their answer to it. The problem is it's just not interesting, and nor do they have anything remotely audacious as Halloween Ends, where you basically transfer evil and have all the Corey character, you know, take over the narrative, and they make it almost like this doomed romance, kind of like Twin Peaks style.
Which they tried a little bit in Strangers, but it's dumb.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it's out of nowhere.
And it's also like, at least, you know, we talked about with the David, you know, Gordon Green movies, is that, you know, the first movie It does follow a pretty similar track. The Strangers movies, the first movie is almost like a straight up slasher, not really remake, but like sequel.
Yeah.
And then the second one is like this bottle episode about the ramifications and consequences of what happens with Michael Myers' crimes on the town. And then the third one feels like the movie that they had to make the first two to have an excuse to make the third. Because the third feels like a true David Gordon Green film.
Yeah.
It feels like the movie that he wanted to make the whole time, but probably couldn't get past the studio without all of the buildup to it. The thing with these Strangers movies, there's no Halloween end. There's no movie that you get to. Like, you can see that with Chapter 3, they're trying to do something kind of audacious. But, like, you get to it, and even that, like, still ends up being a pretty routine revenge movie. Where Halloween Ends is pretty in your face, and it's pretty radical in terms of its approach to that IP.
Yeah, well, this is, simply put, these movies are fucking dumb. Like, that's, I mean, I'm sorry, like, but they're dumb. Like, the script is dumb.
Yeah.
Like, the characters are dumb.
The motivations change, like, scene to scene.
I looked up, I don't know what else they wrote. I'm sorry to the, you know, I apologize. I'm not calling you dumb, these writers, but like, it's a dumb.
You might be dumb though.
Yeah, but it's a dumb script.
Yeah, and they should have steered clear of contact sports. That's for sure.
It's, you know, but it is one of the dumbest things I've seen in a really long time, because to your point, I don't know what's worse, if it is ignorance or laziness. You know what I mean? Like, ignorance as to what makes a quality movie, or just the script feels as lazy as Harlan's direction in a lot of these set pieces. We're kind of like, dip, 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 dip. You know, like they're going through the motions. And it's funny because, like, from the beginning, the reaction to the chapter one was so negative. It played at Fantastic Fest, and people were, like, booing from what I heard. Like, I heard it was just terrible. Like, it did not play well.
I didn't realize it played at Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, it was like a sneak. It was, I think it was a
secret screening.
It might have just been a premiere. I mean, they weren't booing, but people were openly hating it. Like, all online, they were just like talking mad shit. Also, that's like the most. Can you imagine these movies with Fantastic Fest? Like, oh my god,
the knives would be out.
Oh my god, with horror fans. Like, this is like a non horror fans horror movie.
Oh, 100%. It is very much like a passive horror fan, or like if you just want something on in the background, it's almost like screensaver cinema.
Totally.
But like, chapter three, at least attempts something with the flashbacks within the flashbacks, and then also like her becoming a killer in order to hunt them down. But I'm not going to lie, like, it's so jaggedly put together that there were times where I had trouble kind of following it because, like, I didn't realize what time period we were in. Also, like, Richard Brake, this is, again, another one of the things to where, like, it felt like a streaming series, because Richard Brake shows up in the first movie, doesn't have any fucking lines, and then becomes a major part of two and three, to where, like, when he shows up, you're like, Richard Brake is the guy from the Rob Zombie movies. Like,
right. He's
clearly going to have something to do here. Like, why hasn't he spoken yet? Also, Richard Brake shows up and you're like, all right, well, how evil is this guy? Like, he's clearly the bad guy. He looks like Richard Brake. God literally gave him the face of a horror movie.
He's the Richard Lynch of our modern age.
He really is. Just
the same. You're like, well, that guy's bad.
Like, he shows up and you're like, you've never played a nice person. So when, I don't think you're going to start now. We'll put it that way.
You literally killed Batman's parents.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
And was I crazy? Or in chapter three during the flashbacks, did they do like CGI smoothing on his face to make him look younger?
Yep.
And I was like, he still looks like Richard Brake.
That's one of the funnier parts of these movies too, is like, again, like, these people have never like watched a documentary about law or read a book. So literally in cold blood, these two kids murder a young girl with a rock and then play with her blood.
At school.
In front of like teachers. And they run out. And then the kid, it turns out, is the son of the sheriff.
Right.
And he said,
Richard Brake.
Because the judge goes, you know, just because he's so young, I'm going to remand him to your custody, sheriff. Sheriff's like, thank you. And he's like, but if anything happens, I'm sending him to jail. And the sheriff's like, cool. And like, you're like, wait,
I run the jail.
That's not how that works. You know, it's insane.
Well, it's small town law.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing, too, is it starts in chapter three, starts trying to implement all of this mythology and like rule setting to where like Richard Brake gets the kid. And like they set rules to where like you're allowed to kill, but it can't be any townsfolk. And that's why it becomes strangers that they murder at like right. the motel or the cabins or whatever that they hunt down. Cause it has to be out of towners so they can get rid of the bodies and nobody will miss them.
Right.
And like, but at the same time, Richard Brake kills his deputy.
Yeah.
In cold blood in the morgue. In the police station, and then proceeds
just drags to
drag a body bag in broad fucking daylight. Like I was watching that scene, being like, "This isn't real." Like they did one take on this, and they're like, "Yep, we got it. Gotta go." like it's like, and then there's a whole scene where there's three people because then they also introduce in chapter three. It's crazy for the shortest movie. They pack more shit into this one, which at least like keeps you engaged with it.
Yeah.
Which I can't say the same about the first movie. But like you have like this new character who comes he's almost like the brother in Friday the 13th Final Chapter.
Well, it's her sister and her sister's
husband.
And then a giant black man who's like their hired gun.
Bounty hunter or whatever.
It's so weird.
I don't. Yeah, it's but they're like watching him drag this body, and instead of intervening or you know getting any other authorities that aren't this sheriff, they're just watching. They're like,
follow him.
Well, it's not her body. It's too small. That body's too big. I'm like, really? Like, this is what we're doing? Like, we're just watching this happen? Like, this to your point, like, these movies are so fucking stupid. They become almost like avant-garde at certain points where I'm just, like, watching and being like, who thought this was a good idea? And obviously, you guys didn't have enough money to be like, we're going to do a second take and just, like, maybe work this shit out in post or something. It's completely baffling movie. And then you have this entire subterranean showdown
at the old mill
where they find the meat compactor where they grind the bodies up. But then there's also like this shrine to the girl that he loves, that the main killer, you know, has this whole like shrine to her. And then there's a final showdown, but in like the last moments, they kind of fall in love. And I don't know, like this was the point where like my eyes were glazing over and I was like, let's just get through this. Like, can we just get to the credits? Thankfully, again, mercifully short, but like to its credit, at least chapter three was doing some stuff. Where, like, the rest of this series was just complete fucking nonsense.
Well, Matt, so we were talking offline, too. Like, what I would have done if someone's like, hey, you have to write a Strangers trilogy. If you're going to do mythology, do crazy cool mythology. Like, they had this whole thing early on. They all go to this weird church. I'm like, dude, what if they're part of some fucking cult or they're worshiping some god in the basement of that fucking mill? Like,
nope.
But imagine if that was the movie. Like, your jumping off point is Strangers, and all of a sudden,
Martin, that would require thought.
But imagine if you had a Cthulhu monster in the bottom of that mill. You're fucking in, bro. But
yeah, what if that mill was the mill from like Graveyard Shift, and yeah, there was like a weird rat monster thing that they were sacrificing people to? At least, again, they're doing a thing.
It's like Pig Blood Blues from fucking Clive Barker.
Yeah.
You know, like something cool, but it has no personality and.
So my biggest comparison for this beyond the David Gordon Green Halloween movies is also the Rob Zombie Halloween movies, is that it almost feels like an inversion of what he did with the first Halloween remake. Is that with the first Halloween remake, when you watch roughly the first hour, all of the Michael as a kid stuff.
Oh, God.
At least, to be fair, Rob Zombie's doing his thing. He's doing something new. whether you like it or you don't, it's like he's at least attempting something and has his own kind of vision. And then it's almost like he woke up, or like the Weinsteins probably like poked him or something. We're like, hey, you are remaking Halloween, so we're gonna need some of that from you too. That can't just be all this like kid kills people in the woods bullshit, like white trash nonsense. So like, and then he just jams all of Halloween
into 40 minutes
and just speed reads through it until you get to the end. Like, this is almost like the inversion of that, to where like the first movie is just a straight up remake. And then after that, it's like, okay, now we're going to fill in all the gaps as to why you're watching any of this shit to begin with. But again, the simple fact remains that it's like adding mythos and psychology and backstory, it just completely misses the point of like what made the original Strangers movie scary, is that it's like, it's about the unknowability of evil and like how random violence can strike and destroy your world at any moment, and usually when you least expect it. And this is just not interested. I mean, this explains who Tamara is, which I never needed to know.
No.
It, you know?
Yeah, it's the dumbest thing of like, again, that's my, think, the moment in the original, the Bertina film, like, that I think is so special, is that randomness, and that is Tamara home is so creepy. And like, it's almost like, you know what it is? It's fucking Patton Oswalt. You like Darth Vader? Get to see him as a little kid. You want to know what Tamara is? I do not need to know who Tamara is. Like, no, in,
never thought about it until right now. Least. Well, Martin, we did it.
We did it.
We got through all three Strangers movies. I got to be honest. After this recording, I'm never going to think about these movies again.
I've already forgotten most of it.
Rennie Harlan, I love you, but I don't know what possessed. I mean, I don't know what bill you basically had to pay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had some tax debt or like Finland. I don't know. I mean, you know, God bless you, sir, but like maybe you should retire now and just like live in whatever summer home these movies paid for.
But we do have a Shark movie coming out from him.
Yeah, it's true. He hasn't retired, and it has Aaron Eckhart in it again.
And there, I think it's theatrical, because like the trailer's like from the director of Cliffhanger and Deep Blue Sea.
Deep Blue Sea.
They're like leaning in on his old bona fides. And like the idea is a 747 crash lands in the ocean and there's sharks. And I'm like, dude, seeing Rennie back in Sharkland, I mean, we're going to fucking watch it.
Yeah.
We're going to watch it together.
Probably.
Yeah.
Here's the question, though. And actually, two-prong question. Question 1A and 1B. 1A, do you think that his new shark movie, whose name is escaping me, I think it's like Last Breath or something.
Something like that.
Do you think it'll have a rap like theme song, the way Deep Blue Sea did with LL Cool J?
My head is like a shark's
deepest,
fin.
Deepest, bluest, my head is like a shark's fin. Do you think we'll get another one? Honestly, what if it's Aaron Eckhart rapping it?
Dude, if he got LL Cool J to be in this movie, I would die. Like, that would be a coup.
Second question. Do you think a rap song would have helped the Strangers? You know, kind of like the Maniac Cop rap song?
Dude, I watched Maniac Cop 2 last weekend.
What if the stranger's knocking at your door at 4 in the mall?
It's the Maniac Cop. Whoa.
It's the strangers. Just like get the whoever's still living from the Fat Boys.
I was just going to say, what is it? Freddie, what was the rap song?
I think it was the Fat Boys. Was it the Ghetto Boys?
No, it was Fat Boys. But was it Here Comes Freddy?
Here Comes Freddy.
They had the 45 release you could get, I remember. Like at the,
I have it.
Oh my god,
mm-hmm.
I fucking love that song.
It's one of my prized record possessions. But what do we got next?
We're going into kind of, I mean, one of my favorite filmmakers,
and a filmmaker that honestly we're kind of switching roles here. In that, you know, with Larry Cohen and the Italian stuff, like you were watching my guys and kind of discovering them. We're going to go down the rabbit hole of John Boorman because, you know, the Excalibur Arrow release just came out. I literally got it delivered today. It's sitting right there next to me.
So pretty.
You know, and then we also have that documentary about him making Exorcist II, Boorman and the Devil, which we've already seen and is going to hopefully play at some festivals coming up that we're going to attend here soon.
Yeah.
And then we're going to go into the entire filmography of John Borman because, frankly, I've never seen Excalibur. I'd never seen Hell in the Pacific. I just watched it the other day, and let me tell you, it was fucking awesome.
It's a very you movie, too.
There's a lot of his stuff. I've never seen Hope and Glory. There's a huge chunk. He's just one of those filmic. I've never seen Zardoz.
Oh, buddy.
Yeah, like, he's just one of those guys. And also, apologies to our buddy Simon Abrams out there, who's one of the biggest Zardoz fans ever.
Yeah, my friend Becca, too. Huge. She has a Zardoz tattoo on her thigh.
I showed the trailer because I was watching Deliverance, and Savannah came home, and she was watching the end, and she did the thing where she, like, looked at me, and she went, "So, what prompted this?" And I was like, "Ah, this is the next guy we're going to do." And she's like, "Really? What else did he do? Blah, blah, blah." And I was like, "Oh, and he did Zardoz." She goes, "I don't know what that means." And I'm like, "Let me show you the trailer. I haven't seen it either." And I played the trailer for it. And like halfway through, she was like, "Could you turn this off? Because I don't know, man. Like, this looks like somebody just filmed their bad acid trip."
Oh, dude, you're going to love it. It is bananas.
I can't wait because we're using this episode as an excuse for me to fill in a knowledge gap, but you have to tune in next time to hear what I think about all the movies about John Borman. Stay tuned.
See ya.
Bye.
Is that what happens to us? No time for friends. Only our enemies leave roses. Violent lives ending violently.
The war has begun. Friends have murdered your dying son. You can choose to flee or choose to fight. Your mind makes right. There's no war
pushing.
No
frozen war.
No one can push you farther.
Be harder.
Through pain, bring strength within. Winding shatters unworthy men. Prisoners are tied with another excuse. Victims of your own abuse.
No.
Maybe he's not, you know, Ridley Scott or something, but I think Randy Harlin's a tremendous filmmaker. Like, Adventures of Ford Fairlane is, you know, as far as an Andrew Dice Clay vehicle goes, it's pretty decent. And, you know, Cliffhanger is incredible. As far as the whole, like, man against nature type of movies go, it's absolutely amazing.
Shut the fuck up!